Good evening. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the LSE for this evening's lecture, Taking Back Control, Brexit and the Future of Europe. My name's Peter Ramsey. I'm chairing tonight's event. I'm a professor of law here at the LSE. I'm very pleased to welcome and honoured to welcome our guest lecturer, Professor Wolfgang Streeck, tonight to the LSE in this event organised by the Law Department in partnership with the European Institute and the School of Public Policy at the LSE. Professor Streeck has long been one of Germany's leading public intellectuals, an economic and political sociologist, and an influential figure on the European left, broadly speaking, for many years. He is now the Emeritus Director of the Max Planck Institute for the Study of Societies in Cologne. And in the last 5 years, he's added to his immense record of publications two books translated into English, Buying Time, The Delayed Crisis of Democratic Capitalism, and How Will Capitalism End, which have had a huge influence on the understanding of the processes of globalization, and particularly as they have developed in Europe and the responses of European societies in this period. They've had a huge influence well beyond Germany. So it's a great pleasure to welcome you. This evening, Professor Streeck will examine the legal and political questions surrounding Brexit, and in particular in the context of the development of capitalism in Europe at this critical moment. It's particularly appropriate, I think, that Professor Streeck should talk to us this week in London, since it seems to me that Buying Time is probably the most important book ever written about kicking the can down the road. Before I hand over to our speaker, I would just ask you, remind you to put your phones on silent, because the event will be recorded for a podcast, which, providing there are no technical issues, will be available on the LSE website after tonight. For those of you who are Twitter users in the audience, the hashtag is #LSEBrexit. So please tweet away. As usual, the far exits are here and at the back, I have to tell you. As usual, you'll have your chance to put your questions to our speaker after he's finished. But now, will you join me in welcoming Professor Wolfgang Streeck to the LSE?
How do I do this here? Ah, good. Good evening. I have a somewhat complex agenda because I wasn't quite sure what the expectations would be of someone who hasn't lived through the Brexit experience in this country, which I understand was a pretty painful experience for quite a few people. What I will do is, I will try to relate some impressions of the British debate that one could have from the outside, and then say something, beginning by the history and the nature of the so-called European project, and then say something on how I feel that the British are interpreting their own interests in relation to this project, and then a few words on what the future may bring, although the future is something that we, by definition, don't know. We can only guess what it is like. I begin with history and nature of the European project. Now, first of all, one reason why British politics was so ambivalent about Europe is that you can understand it in two ways. And this has something to do with internationalization, globalization, and the rise of neoliberalism. You can see Europe as a superstate, as a potential superstate, with a social policy attached to it, collective bargaining, and so on, which was the nightmare of Margaret Thatcher, when she looked at this emerging political system. You could also see it as a liberalization engine, as an instrument that takes the national national politics out of the national state and subjects national states to a code of competition policy, of abstention of the state in terms of economic policy, no industrial policy, and all of these things. Liberalization engine. Yeah? Over time, this ambivalent creature, so to speak, and the perception of this ambivalence goes back in the debate among, interestingly, those people that we call the globalists, the neoliberal tradition going back to Hayek and von Mises, well into the 1950s and 1960s. They had this problem of what to do with Europe, with regional integration. One wing was of the view that Europe would be a possibility to try out a kind of supranational structure that neutralizes the nation state as a democratic nation state with this permanent inclination to intervene in the distributional outcomes of the capitalist economy. Yeah? That goes back to the 1920s and 1930s when Hayek and von Mises were extremely concerned about the rise of nation states as potentially anti-liberal agents that would interfere with the logic of the market. That's why they called themselves neoliberals, because they wanted to recreate the liberalism of the period before 1914. Gold standard, an open global economy, and nationalism was the enemy, because nationalism could be driven by national majorities that would demand social security, equality of more equality of incomes, and so on. And among this group of neoliberals, there were these two things. One is Europe could be used as an exercise field for a political economy that neutralizes the nation state. The other thought that no, if you start with Europe, then it becomes a subunit of the global economy that begins to intervene in their own economy. And Thatcher was never sort of, Thatcher was clearly on the second position, whereas others, social democrats, especially the people like Hayek, the real globalists, were against European unification. The problem was sort of historically resolved. The beginning of European economic integration was a case of regional planning, as Karl Polanyi in an article in 1945, 1 year after the Great Transformation, sort of precisely outlined. There he had the following problem. How could a majority and a plurality of states sort of form a peaceful regional federation? His answer was they needed to be economically connected. But at the same time, that connection could not be a free market gold standard connection, because he anticipated that countries subject to a gold standard could not be democratic. That this was an insight John Maynard Keynes had developed in the 1930s, because their governments had to enforce on them the rules of competitiveness if they weren't competitive enough. And the Italian situation, if you want, the so-called structural reforms. Yeah. So at first it was actually regional planning, a few industries like coal and steel, yeah, and quotas allocated. And then in the 1970s, after the end of the post-war period, slowly this thing became a market-driven institution, culminating in the internal market with the so-called four freedoms. Capital, labor, services, and what's number four? Anyway, I always forget. This is one problem I have. If I have a list of four, I always forget the last. Yeah. It doesn't matter where I begin, but yeah, it's a problem. So the European Union started with regional planning, turned neoliberal in the 1990s, and became a geostrategic project in the 2000s when the eastern countries had to be integrated. And as a neoliberal geostrategic project, it turned into what I sort of described as the liberal empire in this LSE block, to which Peter Ramsey sort of responded in a way that I take as a very friendly amendment. Now, if one looks at this history, the third point becomes important. Namely, there is no democratic deficit in the European Union that could be remedied. The European Union was, from the beginning, designed to be insulated from popular electoral politics. That was the very idea of this institutional structure. Initially, because of nationalism. Jean Monnet was of the view that people were too nationalist to ask them to integrate into a larger... Then we do it secretly. Yeah, we don't have to talk about it. We do it through the mechanism of spillover, as he described. We begin with coal and steel, and then adjacent sectors would have to be slowly integrated. Technocratic idea rather than political, of European integration. So first, it had to be shielded from nationalism. And later, in the Hayekian globalization mode, from anti-liberalism or from social democracy. Now, it turned out that then the European system became a system where national governments who wouldn't and couldn't be controlled anymore by the electorate, only partly, yeah, had to go and get decisions from the European Center that they could then present to their voters as unfortunately inevitable. Yeah? We have a common market here, so we can't do this, we can't do that. The neoliberalism means a withdrawal of the state from the governance of the economy to the extent that governance could be influenced by democratic majorities. In order to do that in a democracy, this is not Chile. Yeah, in order to do that, you need a mechanism by which you can explain why you can't do what people would like you to do, and Brussels became that engine. So very briefly, look at the Brussels institutional setup in order to understand how this insulation from democratic pressures in Brussels works. You have the so-called parliament, which is now being elected. The parliament has no right of legislative initiative. It can only respond to material that is passed to them by the executive, the council. And the council becomes the most important legislator because the parliament can only say yes or no. Yeah? So we have a very strange authoritarian institution here where the most important legislator and the executive are the same institution. And the rights of the parliament are not defined by the parliament itself, but they are defined by the treaties between the countries that are members, which means that the parliament doesn't decide what the executive can do, but it's the other way around. The executive assigns to the parliament the rights that the parliament has. I always understood why the British found this a very strange parliament. Yeah? It's a parliament sort of instituted by the executive. And then, in addition, the constitution of this whole structure consists, first of all, of the treaties. And the treaties are under the control of the member states. The member states have always seen themselves, as they call themselves, the masters of the treaty. Yeah? Not the parliament. So the parliament can't change the constitution, even with a two-thirds majority. Moreover, the Commission, which sometimes pretends to be a government, the Commission, when it comes to the crunch, never really decides anything. So remember the refugee crisis, when Angela Merkel, without a mandate from any European body, sort of negotiated the deal with Erdogan in Turkey. And Herr Juncker was sitting back and smiling, which he's pretty good at, but he didn't do anything in this. Yeah. He had no powers, also no motivation to interfere, or look at the way the crisis of 2008 was managed. That was Merkozy, yeah. Then Merkel plus Hollande, then Merkel plus Macron, but the Commission was not an instrumental player in this. So in addition, sort of the very importantly, the Constitution is also being written not by the member states, in addition to this, by the European Court of Justice. And what the European Court of Justice rules is almost by definition constitutional, because there's nobody that can change it, except the European Court of Justice itself. Yeah, it's something that to a British mind must be completely exotic. Yeah, completely exotic. This is not a democracy. These institutions are actually designed to be immune to electoral democratic pressure. And you add, of course, this very strange construction of the European Central Bank, the fifth institution, which is unique in the world because it doesn't have a government to confront it. It has 26 or so governments to confront it, whereas any normal central bank has a finance minister sort of as an interlocutor on the part of the government. Yeah. Not this one. So he sort of rules like he pleases. Fourth point, then in this very strange construction, internationalization, that is the loss of control by national governments over policy, is sort of legitimated for the left spectrum of politics by the immigration complex. Yeah? On the left, immigration is sort of the gold standard of openness, of internationalism. It is in the European system closely linked to the four freedoms, apart from immigration from the outside. Yeah? I just want you to consider this a little bit. The politics of the four freedoms. Yeah. And this sort of may tell you something about how the confusion in the British political system between the left and the right. After the internal market was completed, goods, services, capital, and labor were all equally sort of had the right to circulate freely in the internal market. The neoliberals sort of want to keep all four, because this is the core of neoliberalism. There's no borders anymore. Yeah. Then, of course, there are, on the left, people who have complaints about free markets in goods, services, and capital. But at the same time, they, for moral or whatever reasons, believe in the free circulation of labor. And politically, sort of, labor mobility is being sold as inevitably linked to the free markets, yeah, and so I say the no border left is tries to get rid of the market of the first three freedoms, but then tries to defend the other one, and then liberal centrists, soft Brexit, want to keep the three, and are willing to abolish the fourth, yeah, and. The economic nationalists, maybe those who fall back, they want control over all four movements. Yeah? And this sort of creates a very strange linkage between the globalizing neoliberals and the left political spectrum. this may help to understand how these paradoxes come together. Few words on national interests. There are national interests, I would say, and to understand the European Union, you have to look at it as an assembly of nation states with its own interests, also in relation to the European Union itself. The common interest is to use this instrument as a rule of, as a mechanism of authoritarian governance. Yeah? But below this, location, size, tradition, expectations in the international arena, and capacities, military, economic, institutional, all play a role in making for different interests for different countries in this agglomeration. Like, of course, the Polish interest is different from the French interest in that the Poles have a common border with Russia and the French have a nuclear capacity. Yeah. That colors what countries consider their own interests. And within this framework, they try in domestic political debates and conflicts to define what their interests are. Finally, on this subject, what we are seeing there is a Europe of mutually entangled sovereign nation states, and all of these concepts play a role here. They are still sovereign, but they are also mutually entangled, so that they have to look at each other when they do something. There are interdependencies, but when it comes to the crunch, they will insist on their sovereignty. And every country finds a different formulation for this. For example, the French have this, or Macron now has this interesting concept of what he calls a sovereign France in a sovereign Europe. And then you can begin to think, what does the guy mean? Yeah. And what do the other countries think when they hear the French president to talk about a sovereign France in a sovereign Europe? Basically, I think it conjures up the image of the French state as the center and the rest of Europe sort of being an extension of the French state, which is not surprising because that's an old French doctrine about what Europe should be like. Yeah, you don't have to, it's simple, it's a simple fact. And as far as other countries are concerned, Germany has a sort of interest not to be seen as all too powerful, because this conjures up historical memories, which are very much a part of national identity, as a result of which they feel that they should act only together with the French. And they are using the French, so to speak, as a shield. Yeah? But you can immediately see that these two things do not necessarily could converge. That could result in conflicts. Yeah. So I prefer to sort of tone down the rhetoric about a European project and look at real nations, national interests in the context of a political economy that is in jeopardy because it can no longer be democratically governed. So they help each other in imposing or devising policies that they can sort of enforce on their populations. And this is my view of how this thing works. Now, let me say something on how one sees the British in this game. Yeah. The British are very much part of the strange history of the European Union. Labour used to be against the European project, because they thought it was a capitalist conspiracy. Yeah. But that was already in the 1970s. The Tories were against Europe because they thought Europe was a socialist conspiracy. And New Labour was for Europe because they thought Europe was a neoliberal conspiracy and they liked it. And put this together, you can begin to understand the strange divisions in the British debate on this. I call this, at the beginning, malevolent neglect. Yeah? The British public were happy to collect their various rebates, collect the structural assistance, for example, like 2 billion euros every year for regional policies, flowing into the sixth largest economy in the world, because they apparently have no money for regional policy. They need to get it from German taxpayers. So malevolent neglect. And they had all these opt-outs and various benefits of membership. Otherwise, they cared very little. And what my impression for decades was that the British didn't really care about Europe. And when this Brexit thing began, suddenly Europe was a love affair, especially of my fellow academics in Britain. I used to think it had something to do with the European Research Council and the money that you could get from there, but it seems that it's even deeper. It seems like emotional. Yeah? Or sometimes people love the money and then they begin to develop emotions. It's what you call a marriage of convenience. It's all possible, but this is very strange, because at some stage in this story, they moved from malevolent neglect to moral enthusiasm. Yeah. Now all of a sudden, Brexit became a moral issue about being cosmopolitans and Europeans, as opposed to being little Englanders or racists. Like in, and this is very much also in other countries, it reflects a new sort of population structure between people who see themselves as cosmopolitans and people who think that these cosmopolitans are leaving us and they don't want to pay taxes here anymore, and they prefer a world economy where nobody can tax them. And the British taxes are already very low, the lowest in the larger countries of Europe. So, like in other countries, good versus evil, a politics of emotion, of sentimentality, of identity. In Germany, we sometimes discuss it as a sacralization of Europe. Europe becomes a sacred object. You can also say an empty identifier. Yeah? Everybody can project what they think is good on this thing which they call European project. And the great advantage is that nobody defines it. So our governments are extremely hesitant to say what the European project is. Is it a super state? Is it a bunch of friendly countries? Is it a neoliberal thing? Does it have a social dimension? And so people abstain from this. And in fact, they even pretend that it is something that it is not. For example, the latest narrative in Germany is the European Union has brought us peace. Now, if you think about it, the European Union exists since 1958, but we have peace since 1945. And if you think about the reason for peace in Europe, then it's pretty simple. Germany, after the capitulation, was divided into three or four or five different parts, depending on how you count. Yeah? And this little small thing, which is called West Germany, sort of became integrated in NATO. Yeah? And the Americans had 400,000 troops, soldiers in Europe. And Germany was divided in four zones. There was an East Germany, which was integrated into... Yeah, that settled the question of European hegemony once and for all. It was not to be Germany. And that was the big issue since the mid-19th century. So that was the basis of peace. And then on the basis of that peace, you could have a European Union, yeah? But not the other way around. It's simple realism, but in the sort of, in this strange debate, full of sentimentality, yeah? The story is then told after the war, everybody saw that this was a mistake, And now we begin to love each other, and we have to work together for the common benefit. Yeah, that is not how politics works. And there's also this thing: after the war, everybody gave up on national sovereignty. Yeah, the opposite is the case. The European Union was created in order to restore the sovereignty of European nations. Italy, for example, would not have hung together after the war between the South and the North without the regional policy and the open labor market that, that the European Union invited for Germany. Germany went into the European in order to become a recognized nation state again. Yeah. You could say Germany could not have been united as a nation state in the early 1990s had it not been integrated in the European Union. And indeed, more integration was the price for it. Yeah. So you can take country by country. For example, take Ireland. Why the Irish are, in my view, one of the most nationalist peoples in the world. They are really in love with themselves. And at the same time, they are ardent Europeans. Yeah. Why? Because entering Europe and sitting at the same table as the British Prime Minister for the first time solved the problem of Ireland being an independent nation. It settled this question. Because now Ireland was on the same stage as the United Kingdom, yeah, which since the 1930s was always sort of shaky. What is the status of Ireland as a state? Yeah. By joining the European Union, Ireland settled its national identity. Yeah. The same holds, for example, for the Baltic countries. Why did they want to join the European? The Baltics are also extremely nationalist in the sense that they are sort of convinced that, that they want to remain what they are. Yeah. But they wanted to be the European Union, not in order to give up their statehood, which they had sort of extracted from the Russians. No. In order to have it defended, yeah, and so it's all like a debate that goes from national interest to universal values, Europe as an empty identifier, and the strangest narratives. Yeah, I when I talk about this, I try to oppose this very explicitly because I think only after we've gone beyond this we can understand what is going on. And I will show this with my second or with another diagram. So this is the complicated affair of Britain, yeah? And of British national interest as defined over time. The left before Thatcher saw Europe as a device to preserve the voluntarism of the European, of the British industrial relations system. Yeah. Now, you didn't have to have legislation. Unions wanted to be free. And Europe would bring in legislation. Whereas the Harold Wilson people saw Europe as a way of modernizing the country. After Thatcher, the few left-wingers that are still for leave want to restore a socialist option. Whereas the Remain people seek protection from the right. I've never seen a country where the left is so demoralized as Britain. The idea that you need this sort of puny political structure in Brussels to defend yourself from the right. Yeah? It has never worked. But people seem to believe that this is the anchor. Yeah, and for example, I mentioned regional policy. Britain gets 2 billion euros every year for each one. In spite of this, regional disparities in Britain are gigantically high compared to other European countries, except Italy. Yeah, it hasn't worked. But it gives people the feeling that something is being done and we don't have to do it, something about it. Yeah. It's a strange passivity. And if you ask, why do you want to stick to this very strange arrangement? They would say, after Brexit, we are so helplessly exposed to the mean conservatives who will abolish the last remnants of labor law, whereas Britain had always these opt-outs from European directive, yeah, very strange. So, now of course the right sort of initially wanted to defend sovereignty, today, those that stay in, want to stay in, see Europe as an extended playing field for Britain, and to obstruct the French-German continental empire from within. I can say a little more on this later, but I want to conclude and go to the future to the extent that one can say something about it. So post-neoliberalism, post-Brexit, and I assume that there will be Brexit, because if there will be no Brexit at this point, the British will have to return to the European Union after a deep humiliation. Yeah. I think the French and the European Union will sort of really make you feel that you're not going to... It's Canossa, right? I mean, the German emperor going to see the Pope at the castle at Canossa, falling to his knees and asking to be taken back. Yeah? It's Canossa. And I don't think for the British have this sort of sense of national dignity. It will be very hard to suffer this. But even more, within the European Union, nobody in the future will want to try to get out. And that's something that the French and the Germans will like. Yeah? You will be used. So there is, I assume there will be Brexit. And then the question is, since we have to put this in the context of the end of the neoliberal political economic regime, which since 2008 is in a deep crisis. Two modes of anti-neoliberalism. One coming out with anti-internationalism and the other with democratic supranationalism. Yeah? Democratic supranationalism, Jürgen Habermas, and I think this is finally dead. Yeah? So all we can bet on is sort of anti-internationalism and hope to make it democratic anti-internationalism. In other words, return to a democratic national polity. That is what I understand is behind the more sort of supportable parts of the Brexit movement. Yeah? To regain democratic control in your own country through extricating yourself from external fetters, the Italians call it vincolo esterno. Yeah? The Italian concept is we need, the Italian elite, we need to contract in an external fetter, yeah, in order to be governable again. Yeah? This was the language of the Banca d'Italia before joining the euro. Yeah? The vincolo esterno. And the idea is that since neoliberalism isn't working anymore, the idea may be to go back and recapture control. The result would be a more nation-centered international order, and it is worthwhile thinking about how that order could look like. Speculation is that it might be an era of decentralization and repoliticization. Neoliberalism is dying, and there is pressure. And I see the Brexit vote and many other things taking place as a desire for smaller political units to recapture some kind of self-control. For example, it's not just Brexit. It's Scotland, but it's also Catalonia. Many countries sort of think about decentralizing their governance because the countries are increasingly difficult to govern from the top. Take a case like Canada, which managed in beautiful ways to deal with centrifugal tendencies in its polity. Now they were able to keep them together, but by deep decentralization. Yeah? And the resistance, for example, in Europe against being governed by Brussels or by Germany and France is extremely strong. It's in the eastern countries, it's in the Mediterranean, and so on. So then it would be interesting to think about something like decentralized democracy. I see that Brexit might be part of a transition to such an era. Centralized rule, and that's an interesting question. Is centralized rule still interesting for the left? The left used to be centralistic, yeah? But now I think we have learned that the transition to a different political economy cannot be ordered from the top, and that there is lots of sort of, we need lots of experimentation at the bottom, yeah? So that national policy might, an ideal national policy for a social democratic or socialist future would be to allow local communities to experiment with new forms of property, economic organization, economic competition, and so on, and to license what the Americans sometimes call laboratories of democracy. In that sense, then, centralization is no longer really as important as it was for a Leninist view of the transition to a different non-capitalist society. Leninism means you capture the central government, and the next morning you have a press conference and say capitalism is over, now we have socialism. And the only way you could get, the only system that you could kill like this was socialism. When Yeltsin sort of gave his press conference and said socialism is over, now we have capitalism. Yeah. But the other way around is not possible. And so I also add to this the notion, which I sort of elaborated in this blog post, that the EU as a Franco-German empire will be unsustainable. I can explain this later. Here my point is simply that the power of the center will not be enough to keep this together, precisely because of these pressures for decentralization and local or national autonomy. Yeah. You could bribe people by bringing them in, but the Germans don't have enough money to do this. Yeah. You could send troops, but this is not polite anymore. You don't do this. Well, sometimes maybe later. You have heard that the Germans are raising their defense budget to 2% of gross domestic product. Yesterday I learned that they want to build an aircraft carrier. Nobody knows where this thing is to go. So, post-Brexit, a new British domestic politics. That's what interests me most, also in the discussion. The cards, I would think, the cards of British politics will be newly mixed. A dynamic view is needed, by which I mean the following. The time of comfortable replacement of national efforts with European Union handouts, economic, institutional, will be over. Yeah? Then people tell me, then we're in dire shape. I answer that in this situation, you will have to mobilize your own political capacities on the left, and you will have to learn to fight for yourself. Yeah? The European Union doesn't do anything for you. It didn't do anything for anyone, except for the Germans, bringing them all this money through the gold standard currency that Germany imposed, or that the French imposed on the rest of Europe, thinking that this would be good for the French. Yeah, they that was a mistake. In spite of European social policy, labor standards are extremely low in the United Kingdom. And I think fighting your own government rather than Brussels may be the right address, right, to go there. Final point. I would suggest that we could think about something like a laboratory of social democracy in post-Britain once they have shed the fetters of Brussels. And I'm serious about this. Britain, free from European Union constraints, can begin to experiment with a departure from unlimited free trade, privatization, abstention from industrial policy, protection of weaker sectors and regions. It will also be able to regulate immigration in line with older obligations, I think, to its citizens of Asian origin. It occurs to me that that the European Union sort of inserts new immigrants into a country that has very deep connections to other parts of the world, especially in terms of family relations. Yeah. It's hard to understand why, under the government of Blair, the British government would go to Poland and Hungary, put up signs, come to Britain. Yeah? I don't know why they did this. Maybe they didn't trust their own working class, and they thought these people were better skilled, and they were. I don't know. And then skilling would be something that country would also have to do, because they can't rely on immigration to fill their skill gaps. And you would have to have a better vocational training system. So according to the economic needs of interests, especially of its less prosperous citizens, that's a pious wish. But I would think, and I would hope, that in the debate on Brexit, and once Brexit has been consummated, the British domestic politics and the domestic political debate will turn to the needs to design a post-neoliberal economic and political order for this country, unconstrained by external obligations to a bureaucracy in Brussels that really hasn't done anything for you. It hasn't done anything for you. And all it does is it prevents you from inventing your own political creativity. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your lecture, Professor Strake. As is usual, the floor is open. I would ask you, if you have a question, to ask a question rather than make your own lengthy contribution to the Brexit debate. I appreciate that perhaps for the British members of the audience, passions are running high at the moment. So if we could just, keep it civilised, that would be great. I'm hoping we have a roving mic. So if people want to speak, show me their hand and I will point you out. If you could say who you are and if you have any particular interest, that would be great. In the front here to start with.
Thank you, Professor Strake. Many people on the left in this country believe fervently in the idea of Remain and Reform. Can you say something to that, please?
Can you say this again? I was
the idea of Remain and Reform. Remain.
Yeah. I think the Brussels system is not reformable. No, it's been produced to be that. Yeah, if you want to change the de facto constitution of the European Union, you would have to have a unanimous decision of the European Council, plus referenda in at least three countries. Yeah, and if you want to change the rulings of the European Court of Justice, you can't do this at all. The Parliament has no right to do this; it has no legislative initiative. You have to wait for the Court of Justice to decide that they have made a mistake. And I tell you, these people are very self-confident. They do not think that they have made a mistake. No, this system is precisely constructed not to be reformable. And it is done this because in the 1960s, 1970s already, the idea was that integration, European integration, should be a gradual, irreversible process. And that's exactly how the system is built.
Yes.
Thank you for an extremely interesting lecture. My question is the following. For me, the gist of it was neoliberalism is over or on the way to be gone. Now we have decentralized democracy or experiments with it. And I was completely convinced about the Brussels part, but I'm very much concerned about how can we actually reach this decentralized democracy. I'm Eastern European, I come from a country which was part of this laboratory for capitalism with disastrous results, right? But I'm also working on social movements. And I think the left is demoralized not only in Britain. The left is demoralized in many places, maybe with the exception of Germany and Italy, and Spain, let's say, Southern Europe. But how can you construct an alternative project if the left is so weak and if you have such a strong nationalist movement? Because it seems to me that we might unleash things that are worse. So I'm completely convinced by your criticism, but I'm very worried about the way forward. And the,
can everybody
promises.
Hear the question at the back? So that's okay. Right.
Yeah. The only thing I can say is that we are facing generally a problem of a transition from a sort of globalized capitalism model to something else. The model of global capitalism has not worked. Yeah? And it has created enormous resistance, not just in this country, but elsewhere too. That resistance expresses itself in part in movements that we would as leftists, not really appreciate. Yeah. What is the answer to this? If we take this seriously, the answer would be that the left would have to speak up. We hear little from the left. A language that explains to people why they are in trouble is missing. And in part it is missing because the left was deeply implicated into the internationalization discourse and the free market discourse, at least since the time of the Third Way. Yeah? Now we would have to recapture a rhetoric that, as Peter in his comment on my comment writes, that recaptures the idea of a democratic national community using the only institution that we have for governing an economy and democratizing lives, which is the state. And the states are nation states. If Peter allows, I will say we had in 1945 roughly 60 states in the world. Now we have 200. Yeah? In this period, there's not a single example of two of these states sort of merging into one, except Germany, but Germany was a different case, everybody would recognize. States are extremely fashionable. Countries in Africa and elsewhere, they want their state. Yeah? And telling them that the state is something that you should not use because it's nationalist, yeah? Or telling them that the state is not worth democratizing is a totally sort of useless exercise. Yeah? We have to take the tools that our governments, our states give us, and sometimes it requires a revolution. So what? Yeah? So what? So sometimes the tool to democratize a state is a Kalashnikov.
Brown jacket here, and then of course.
Thank you. Rokhduin Vonsevich, I'm at European Institute. I just wanted to invite everyone to read both blogs on LSE Brexit, because I'm the managing editor of that blog, so both by Professor Schreck and Professor Ramsey, and it's a very interesting conversation that they're having there. I would echo the question from the front. So, I also come from Eastern Europe. I also not have witnessed, per se, what nationalism brought to the region, but that is sort of ingrained in my family history. And in what way, going back to this Westphalian model of the nation state and looking for solutions to the structural transformation of the economy that is happening around the world, is the right way of approaching these externalities that we're dealing with on a global level? I just don't. I think that your criticism of the European construction is very much compelling, but in what way coming back to the nation as the prime source of sovereignty is the right way of going forward. And here I would echo Professor Zielanka, who writes about cities and regions, and why shouldn't we enfranchise them in one way or another? Why do we go back to this idea of national sovereignty?
Yeah, see, I urge not to use a language like, why don't we do this? We do nothing. Yeah? We only think. And if you ask me, why don't you enfranchise regions? Yeah, I'm not God. I can't do this. And then apply a little more realism. The realism is, people say, do you want? I hear this all the time. Do you want to go back to the nation state? My answer is, we live in a world of nation states, and when it comes to really important decisions, they are decisions made by powerful nations. The problem is how to protect less powerful nations from the more powerful nations, like America, like maybe Russia, yeah, like also countries like Germany and France with aspirations to sort of govern other countries as well. So to me, the question is, how can we build a more nation-centered, that it has to be, order that gives a sovereignty to all nations, that they can cooperate freely with each other. So people say, do you want to go back to the nation? Look at how the European Union coped with the aftermath of the 2008 crisis. Yeah. You think the Prime Minister of Estonia had the same influence on the decisions as Merkel and Sarkozy? No. Merkel and Sarkozy walked on the beach, I don't know where this was, somewhere in France, and Sarkozy said to Merkel, Angela, my banks are going to go bankrupt. Yeah? And Angela said, oh God, we have to do something about it. Yeah, it's reported I mean this is the story. And then she went home and said, we need to have a rescue system for the banks. Not saying that it was basically the French banks. Yeah. No, we live in a world of nation states. The question is, how can you use this, the only political institution that could potentially be democratized? The world cannot be democratized. Yeah. How can we democratize it and at the same time protect it from others? That's the task.
Okay. Perhaps the person just next to you there in the purple shirt. I know I'm working the front. I'll get you at the back in a minute.
So some believed in a top-down governance to create multiculturalism and diversity. But I think the internet showed that there's a window of opportunity for a more networked style, decentralized, using peer-to-peer technologies, things like the blockchain as a system of governance, and even a new financial system, a new networked financial system of governance and finance. And I wonder if you saw a possibility in the future of a more networked governance where governance could even supersede locational boundaries. So there could be nation states based on location, but other things based on a network style of governance.
Yeah, I have to disappoint you. I think I read three books on blockchain technology, and I think I'm a pretty smart guy. I don't know what it is. If you do, let's meet afterwards and explain it to you. Yeah, I have seen documentaries about it, and I wasn't smart afterwards.
Yeah. This is a cartoon designed for
a 10-year-old. Yeah, to me, there is a danger that this is a big fraud to get my money. Yeah. So that's the answer on the blockchain. The more serious answer on networks is this. Networks... that's a fashionable concept and has been for 2 or 3 decades when it sort of migrated into sociology. Yeah? They have the advantage that you can sort of apply all sorts of mathematical formula to it. They have a great disadvantage, which is that the concept of power doesn't show up. Yeah? But the world, especially the world of political economy, is a world where power plays a role. Yeah? If you can have a very large network, but if your employer fires you, your employer fires you. Yes? The employers also have networks. And these networks are pretty much more powerful than your networks. Yes? So the world is not a network. That sounds too nice. The world is a system of rule and inequality and the unequal distribution of advantage. And politics, if it is democratic politics, will have to keep up with this and try to moderate the tendencies in our societies, to disrupt them and turn them into places of gross inequality and differently distributed advantage and disadvantage. Yes? Networks don't help much. They may help, they may help in organizing something. But then I have another concern, which is that the modern informational infrastructure, which is these things, which should be a public infrastructure, is owned by three or four Zuckerbergs or whatever they are, yeah, who run this enormously important communication system and do all sorts of bizarre things with the data that you leave there. Yeah? And then I want to put this under some sort of public control. Yeah? And then I'm willing to talk about these things. I used to run a research institute and for more than 20 years. And when these things came up, some of my young researchers, sort of, they said, now the world is completely changing because now we have the internet and the internet cannot be blocked. So information will be distributed. Now the Chinese just throw a switch. Right? All sorts of things can happen. And if power sort of affects technology, technological change, any sociologist can tell you, technological change is not exogenous to societies, but endogenous. Societies invest in and invent things that fit an existing power structure. Not completely, but first, and then come side effects. Yeah? But there was research on how to block the internet, and now they can do it.
Okay. First, over there with the short hair, and then with the red jumper at the back, afterwards, yeah?
Thank you, Professor Streak.
Can you say who you are?
Sorry, Alex Gordon from the People's Brexit Campaign. I was very interested in your... Is this turned on?
Yeah, what do you mean?
Okay.
Can you hear it back?
Very interested in your talk. You've written recently that the EU is a neoliberal empire that is crumbling. And certainly there's a sort of pervasive fantasy here in this country on the left that the EU is something, as Theresa May would say, strong and stable, and that it's simply this country that is locked in an interminable debate about it. But if you're right, then what is the remedy that you're proposing? Because the project of building or democratizing the nation state is not going to be a remedy in many countries where they've lost a third of their population due to population movements within the EU freedom of movement period. There are going to essentially be some countries where there's a possibility of rebuilding the nation state and others that are going to be formal or semi-formal colonies. Could you address what you think that imbalance of power implies?
Yeah, that's an important point in that international systems tend to develop gradients of power between countries, between the center and the periphery, where the center sort of begins to colonize, quote-unquote, the periphery and tells the periphery how to behave. Right? What I'm saying is that there we have a fact of life. That is a fact of life. What I'm saying is that we have to think about alternatives to this. Because I don't see any other way of thinking about a more equitable international order than trying to think about an international order built not on power differentials but on cooperation. And I think that's possible. So, for example, something that the European Union fans usually don't tell us is the following. For example, on the European continent, we have an integrated, by and large, integrated railway system. Yeah? Everybody suggests that this is one of the wonderful products of the European Union. I tell you, it has nothing to do with the European Union. It's something that adjacent countries came together and they made a decision. Let's have trains crossing our border. Yeah? The trains going to Switzerland. Yeah, Switzerland is not a member of the European Union. In fact, Switzerland has the best trains in the world. You travel in Switzerland and the trains come on time. Yeah? It's absolutely amazing. And they
it's got to be Germany where the trains
run. No, Germany is in deep trouble. The German railways are in deep, and it's a very good point that you're making. Why? Because the Schröder government told the management of then the public railways to prepare the railways for privatization. Yeah? And that meant that they didn't invest anymore in where there were long-term, only long-term benefits. They tried to pretty the railway system so that private investors would buy it. Yeah? And now we are realizing that, for example, I live in the area of Cologne. I can't go to work anymore if I go to my office. I still go to my office, although I'm retired. I can't rely on the train system. Yeah. So I had to buy a little car in order to go in, because the train system is completely broken, and it's getting worse. But what I mean to say is that this advantage of Europe, that we now have an integrated train system with identical tracks crossing, is something that is the result of cooperation, not of centralized government. And you can mention many other things, from the postal systems, which are also based on association, not on government. And my view is, the modest proposal is to think about replacing centralized directive government, authoritarian government, by cooperation across borders. There's a lot of things to be achieved by this. That would mean that countries can refuse to cooperate. But then they refuse to cooperate. Then you have to offer them something. Why, for example, should the center of the European Union, like Merkel, yeah, why should she decide that Hungary has to take in 255 refugees? Why is that something for her to decide? It's something that I completely don't understand. And it's something like, I want to educate this boorish guy, what's his name?
Orban,
yeah, or something. Or I want to show to the rest of the world how liberal I am. Yeah? But there's no need for this to be decided in Brussels. Yeah? And so you can take lots of things where Brussels now thinks that they are a government and replace it with a cooperative structure, in the same way in which you can replace capitalist hierarchies by cooperatives between firms, individuals, and so on, by cooperative banks, and so on. Yeah? They do away with Deutsche Bank and have a lot of cooperative banks at the local level. Wonderful.
Hi. I wanted to ask about, you were talking a lot about how the EU has done nothing for us and that there's a portion of the left, the pro-European left in this country, who are somewhat delusional about the idea of the EU acting as a bulwark to the right in this country.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to ask, because it feels like living here, the source of the reason that I can have paid holiday, that I can have sick leave, that I can have parental leave, is EU legislation. So those feel like really tangible wins from a left-wing perspective that come from the EU. And similarly, there are other social consumer protections and environmental regulations that seem like a win from a left-wing perspective. So I was wondering how you can be so sort of complacent about those things. And secondly, how you can be confident that in a country where The Conservative Party, an increasingly right-wing Conservative Party, are ahead in the polls, and their most likely next leader is Boris Johnson. How you can be confident that things are going to get better, not worse?
The answer is not so difficult. I think mobilize the good sense of the majority of your citizens. Return to them the confidence that they, through politics, can do something for themselves and for the country. Why should that be so difficult? All it requires is that this attitude, like we weren't able to get parental leave, so thank you, Brussels, that you stuck it to us. Yeah. No, see, other countries also, parental leave is a relatively new issue. Yeah. In many countries in Europe, initiatives were taken when this came up, and countries developed their legislation. Why shouldn't the British have been able to do that too? And this country, historically, invented the welfare state. This country had one of the most equitable systems in healthcare after the Second World War. And it developed a theory that T.H. Marshall sort of made a worldwide theory from civil rights to political rights to social rights. The British left could have defended this. And there was a time when this was declared to be outdated, and that the status of a citizen should not depend on political or social rights provided by the state, but it should depend on individual effort, skill, competitiveness in international markets, and so on. That was a big mistake. And that story was not just a story of the right, it also was a story of the left. I remember a time, mistakes can be made, yes? And they have historical effects. So, for example, I remember a time in the 1970s when there was a strong interest in this country in the German model of worker co-determination, worker participation in firms and at the shop floor level. And the British trade union movement was divided over it. They made a big mistake. Then they were against sort of legal rights for workers. Yeah. Then the legal rights for workers were given to them by Margaret Thatcher in the form of labor legislation in the 1980s, much, much below the level that the British Labour Party could have legislated in the 1970s. Yeah, mistakes can be made. But it is not that there is something written in, cast in stone, that in Britain you will always have to depend on like Wellington in the Battle of Waterloo. I wish it was night and the Prussians came. Yeah, it's not always night and the Prussians may not come.
Now I've got a hand here in the second row, and then before you, and then the white shirt, man in the white shirt here. Can you say who you are?
Hi, James Hartfield. We had this referendum here, and we asked our parliament to take the sovereignty from the European Union.
Yeah.
And they turned around to us and said, no, we don't want it. And I raise it because I quibble with your realist interpretation of the European Union as self-aggrandizing nation-states, interest-seeking nation-states, to the extent that we seem to have a very, very shy ruling class, almost German. Almost German in their desire to hide. Maybe the Germans were ahead in this hiding their interest and sublimating and disguising. And it does feel like I can't see the people in the parliament would take sovereignty, that they don't seem to be the ones.
Yeah, it is like, I refer to what Peter wrote on the blog and what other people, I mean, this is a long discussion, Peter doesn't allude to it. It goes back to this idea of multi-level government where national executives sort of draw from international agreements additional power in imposing policies on their constituencies, which the constituencies would not have voted for. Yeah? Angela Merkel came back from Brussels and said, look, guys, this is what we have decided, and if we touch it, then we may get a worse deal than that. And then everybody agrees. Meaning that it is understandable why ruling political classes do not want to take sovereignty back if they can sort of park it in a place where they can go and sort of use it when they need it. Yeah? But that doesn't mean that they are no longer sovereign states. They have chosen a way of exercising their sovereignty which makes it possible for them to establish a regime of what I call authoritarian liberalism. Yeah? Liberalism in the economy, authoritarianism in the polity. That's the dream of people like Hayek and von Mises since the 1920s and 1930s. And if you read law journals, I once sort of tried to write something on law and this article, yeah, I've forgotten what the title was. It was like Heller and Carl Schmitt. There I trace how the authoritarianism of someone like Carl Schmitt and the liberalism of economists sort of joined forces in order to develop a model where the state is both strong and weak at the same time. Weak in relation to its economy so that it can remain capitalist, and strong in relation to all forces in society that would have the desire to use the state to intervene in the capitalist economy. Yeah? And one of your, in America, the first, in Britain, the first years of Thatcher, forgot the name, good friend of mine, wrote a book, The Free Economy and the Strong State. Yeah? The Free Economy and the Strong State. That's exactly it. In order to have a free economy, you need a strong state. So these are the two faces of liberalism. Liberalism has brass knuckles when it comes to socialists that want to take over the state, and it goes like a pussycat when capitalists sort of want to invest or don't want to invest. Yes?
White shirt there.
Hi. I think for me personally...
Can you say who you are?
Sorry?
Can you tell us who you are?
Gustav. I'm just with my wife because I'm interested in...
Welcome, Gustav.
In the Brexit debate, and she's also very, very interested in it. So, I mean, like, for me personally, one of the, you know, positive outcomes of Brexit is actually that the whole... torpedoing from the other member states apart from the UK has largely stopped now over the last 1.5 years. So you don't even see that from the right anymore. So you have even Italy kind of stopped torpedoing the EU and its institutions. So do you think it's kind of conceivable if Brexit is finally done that it's actually going to be a huge success, but rather for the EU than for Britain?
No. This requires. I mean, I'm given to talking too long, but this requires a complicated answer. I mean, right now the French, with their centralistic project in Europe, they are happy for the Brits to leave, because the Brits were sort of secret allies of the Germans when the embraces of the French became too painful. Yeah, then the Germans would say.
But now they love each other again, right?
The Brits don't agree with it. And then the French would say, yeah, well, then we have to wait for another occasion. Yeah, and so now the Brits are out, and there's only one nuclear power in the European Union, and there's only one power with the United Nations Security Council seat. And it's only by accident that a few days ago, both the chief of the French General Staff publicly, they never speak publicly, said that the French nuclear force would not defend Germany or Europe. It was there to defend France, basta così. Yeah? It's like that. And they now think they can say that because the British are out. Yeah? And then the foreign minister said that German ideas that the French seat on the Security Council could be converted into a European seat was ridiculous. Yeah? The French seat was a French seat was a French seat. And so, yes, there is this prospect in on the continent that now that the British are out, the French always thought the British don't belong to Europe. Remember Charles de Gaulle, yeah? That you now can sort of integrate Europe more. My view is that this cannot be done without an amount of economic resources that is simply not available. So if you want to maintain the euro, you have to arrange a transfer system to compensate the Mediterranean countries for the permanent economic losses that they will. The debt is not the problem. Debt, my God.
Which is long overdue anyway.
The debt is not the problem. The problem is that they are more inflationary than Northern Europe, and that permanently diminishes their competitiveness. Yeah? And then you need, like in an integrated nation state, you need transfers for the lagging regions in order for the thing not to become too dispersed. Now that requires resources of a dimension that a country even like Germany cannot possibly pay for. It's impossible. And I calculated the amount of transfers that would be needed, I think 4 or 5 years ago, taking France as an additional payer. Germany, Netherlands, Austria, and France would be the paying nations. But France won't pay because they can't. They suffer from the same problem that Italy and Spain have, namely that their economy is inherently more inflationary than the German economy. Why? Well, Macron is trying his best to restructure through internal reforms their political economy, and you see what happens. There are all those yellow vests in the street. Yeah, and he's politically, in that sense, bankrupt. Yeah.
So you believe there's not going to be a big change for the EU?
No, I think it's just... you have to put this into the larger context of the failure of the neoliberal model of capital accumulation, and then the tensions that this generates in the international state system are in part expressed in the fragmentation tendencies of which Brexit is a part, but also Scotland and other parts. And in addition, it manifests itself in the increasing ungovernability of the remaining European Union, which neither the French nor the Germans can guarantee, and not even the Germans and the French together.
Can I stop you there? Because I want to take the last couple of questions, and then we'll go back. So for the people who have been showing for a long time, the black jumper just there, the blue shirt here, and the one at the back at the end of the row, because you've been showing. Those three, if you could be quick, because we're short of time.
I'm going to make this really quick. My name is Sam McCain. I'm Masters at Sussex. In your book, Buying Time, you allude to the fact that from the 1970s onwards, we turned from fiscal accumulation to buying off investors, and that our government is in debt to all these investors, and a lot of our policy comes from appeasing these investors. So my question is, why would this change if we left the EU? We would still be in debt to these investors. And surely if we decided to stop paying these investors, because the way the system works, that we just pay debt with debt with debt, the whole system eventually would just collapse.
Can I take the three questions and round up? So one down here, and one, or if we take the one at the back, quick, be quick, please, because we're very short.
Kevin O'Connor, here. Just a query, a tragedy farce about the party of the European left, like you've seen the farce of the disgusting Syriza government in Greece, but you had Gregor Gysi, the left party, defending this, defending all this, what privatisation. So the party of the European left, which was set up to be more left-wing than the parties, you know, like the parties of the Socialist International, they seem to be conned into accepting this EU project, and they're prepared to accept any privatisation, neoliberalism to keep the euro. So they seem to become just right-wing. It's a great tragedy that even the left party in Germany are defending it. What's your comments on that?
Okay, and final question.
Lee Jones from Queen Mary University of London. I'm struck by a lot of the pushback against what you're saying is either a case of misperception, for example, the EU gave us sick pay, or fear. The right is going to take all our rights away if we dare to leave the EU. And it reminded me of what you were saying about emotionalism. I wanted to question you about that. The idea that the left has become attached to free movement of labour, which is one of the four freedoms of the capitalist market, as being the gold standard of being a good person. So they become a sort of left wing of neoliberalism in a way.
Yeah.
How, and this sacralisation of Europe, it makes it very difficult to have a rational discussion because people are very emotionally invested. How did that happen? How did we move from talking about the EU as an economic and political structure to talking about it as a moral one? And how do we get past that?
So the debt problem, why would it go away? European left, and how do we...
Peter, I know. I hear this. You don't have to say that. There was this undertone. the debt problem. Yeah, the debt problem won't go away by Brexit or by staying in. That's a problem that is so fundamental for the future of capitalism. We will have to think about a global monetary regime without the dollar being the most important part of it. You have to integrate the Chinese economy into this. You have to learn something about flexibility of exchange rates and stability at the same time. We're getting to a very, very fundamental agenda here. And there are people who know more about money than I do, and it's worth thinking about this very seriously. But that's my answer to this. Gregor Gysi and the left. The love affair of the left with the European Union is partly tactical. It is extremely difficult to explain to people that this is a political order, a political institution that you can be for or against without being a bad or good or whatever guy. It's a construction, and you don't have to love it. In fact, I always say the great birthright of a European citizen, and that's in our culture, goes back for a long time, is that you can disagree not only with your government, but also with the way in which your country is governed, and at the same time remain recognized as a patriot, as someone who belongs to this society. Yeah? You can do this. And in fact, we should fight for it. And whenever we say that this European Union was a mistake, or it became a mistake when it turned into a geostrategic or neoliberal project in the 80s and 90s, yeah? If we say that and someone tells us, you're speaking the language of the right, yeah? We have to be very angry and tell them that this is my right, my birthright as a European, to contest the way in which my society is governed. Yeah? That's why I am a citizen. That's my right as a citizen. So you don't believe it. If I in Germany talk about these things, which I do often in these days, then people stand up and they say, this is the way the right speaks about Europe. Then I say, I don't care. This is what I think is the case. Yeah. And as far as the emotional part is concerned, we have to mobilize other emotions. I mean, the left has made the mistake that it sort of left behind the emotion of solidarity, yeah, for a very thinned out, very thin sort of human rights, yeah. Whereas experienced solidarity has something to do with the guy next to me with whom I sort of demonstrate in the streets or organize a strike. So the warm body part sort of disappears in the rhetoric of the left in favor of a very sort of paper-like abstract ideas about cosmopolitanism. And so we have given up the emotional part of this, and we have to go back to it. Nations are part of this. I don't understand why we should not be democratic patriots. Democratic patriots. That is, we want this country to be democratic, and we fight for it.
Thank you, Professor Strike. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.